This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people and the Cambri people and to thank Agnes Shea for her welcome this morning. And I'd also like to acknowledge the Utopia people who came all the way down, including Emily's relatives, and also the people who came from Japan, especially for this event. I said it's been an incredible year in Australia with the apology early in the year and now Emily coming to Australia. But I must admit, I am humbled. Margot said I was nervous. It's partly because I'm not an art historian. And in the lead time to this, I couldn't actually read all the brilliant things they'd written. But I did read quite enough to realise that they've made some wonderful contributions to assisting us appreciate Emily's work. Now, in the project, the Unsettling Histories project that Margot and Francis Peters and Little and I are working on, we have been looking at non-text-based mediums, like, for example, cultural festivals as ways to remember history, all sorts of performances, song, dance, and so art and painting seemed an obvious one to pick. And you could think of Rover Thomas's work, some of which are named after massacre sites, or Gordon Bennett's, which are a wonderful critique of white Australian history. And he adds brilliant new perspectives. And there's many other artists, of course, I could name. Our project was inspired to recognise a different historiography, an understanding and presentation and representation of history by Indigenous people, and we're inspired partly by an author who wrote about North American, Native American traditions, where he points out, of course, that Native American history-telling practices are often in people's memories, in their heads. And in Australia too, there's been quite a lot of study of oral history as an important Australian Indigenous mode of history-telling. And of course, in the general public who are not Indigenous, we remember history in many different ways too, not only in authorised history books. But I think that when you think of colonisation, there is the obvious recognition that Aboriginal people have in their interpretations of colonialism, where they say, you white people brought the law in a book and God was in a book and so, you know, everybody was in a book. And they're very conscious of the reification of the written text and the written word. Emily, of course, speaks without writing. As Margot writes, her paintings speak volumes. Some people might see her paintings as country maps. Thanks to Emily, we perhaps have something that goes way beyond a Melways, Gregory's or Refedex for her dreaming country. There's a moral universe ensconced in the directions she gives us, and routes that are not only for human but all living creatures to follow. And I think some of these routes and maps are ways of looking at history in a fresh way. Now, my slideshow is not that directly connected with what I'm saying. I'm just going to sort of trawl through it just to give you the feel of the wonderful ways she presented that can enable us to think of new metaphors by which to see our world and her specific country. Critics who try to locate Emily's works as abstract, representational, personal or autobiographical themselves get caught up in historical paradigms. The judging scales of art history and the chronologies of art history have been written for Europe, and European dates and events are the timelines. This raises interesting questions, some of which have been addressed by Howard Morphy in his Becoming Art. But the dream time has often been seen as like a different conceptualisation of history or the dreaming, as something that's cyclical rather than linear as compared with Western notions of time. But once you start to locate place as central to analyses of time, there's a different story going on altogether. In this paper, I argue that Emily's paintings and Emily herself must be understood in their historical and imperial contexts. They must be seen as not just being about history, but also being made histories, made into histories, and making history. And as I said, we generally tend to think of oral histories as being where Indigenous people remember their history stories and tell them and share them. And I was thinking about this, and I'm thinking, well, telling history stories via art is not the first effort Indigenous people have made to share their stories with us. Many of them told their stories to people, including David Unipon, whose book was then taken over by a non-Indigenous author and published, even though he'd collected Indigenous stories from all over Australia. But they're usually turned into picture books, and even today they're usually seen as children's stories. I think that's an interesting thing to reflect upon. This interpretation that we see via Emily and via other Indigenous artists is a very sophisticated intellectual story, and it gets away from that problem of when you translate stories into English and then simplify them, they're so often marketed just for children, whereas these stories might be adult stories. In fact, you may have to be an adult man or woman before you even hear these stories. So I think there's been a cultural filtering which is oversimplified and, in fact, viewed them in quite a condescending way as just simple fables. In Australian national history writing, which we take quite seriously, and the previous government took so seriously that we ended up having a history wars about it, we actually think still that our histories start in 1788, even though the nation actually didn't begin until 1901. We're still obsessed by this, and in fact we celebrate it every January. And this tends to overlook what I'm arguing Emily's doing in her work, which is telling a story where the year 1788 becomes quite irrelevant. Aboriginal Australians are still seen by international audiences and by Australian audiences as exotic in many ways, especially compared with other Australians. And so is their art. But what do they actually think about the 60,000 years of knowledge that might be conveyed by some of this art? Indigenous art, like Emily's, in my view, promises to shift the boundary away from 1788 in a way that the picture books never could. The date 1788 was irrelevant to Emily's ancestors. Emily's encounters with the British did not begin until well after she was born, her birth being in the 1910s, even though there was no birth certificate. She stated she recalled seeing the first white man when she spoke to Rodney Goosh and Jenny Green. There are some interviews with her about her life story. In a powerful and frightening image, she actually told of seeing a man who was thought to be a policeman on a horse, and she thought they were both devils, and then there was another horse behind them, and there was an Aboriginal man walking along with a chain around his neck. You could say this story is so sort of archetypal and apocalyptic that perhaps it's a metaphor for white encounter, but no, it happened on a particular day, and Emily said she was with a particular other girl, and she talks about the age they were when it happened. So this is, a very powerful story. And then there's another powerful story of a policeman who took her uncle away and also took her away, and she thought he didn't have, he might have wanted to molest her or kidnap her, and she managed to escape. So there are some frightening stories of first encounter with white men. And it's astonishing, really, that that happened in her own lifetime. Now, although Emily is now famous and definitely a significant Australian, historians or biographers have not attempted a serious, sustained study of Emily's life. I see a need for a contextualisation of her life within the context not just of the beginnings of the Western Desert Art Movement, the batik craft training that she had, etc., but in the context of the following rather traditional chronologies of someone's life, the timelines and themes. And now, ever since I started thinking about Western timelines and history, I keep seeing timelines all over Emily's work. There's a lot of lines, and I keep thinking, was she trying to tell us something about where her timelines went? And so I think that there does need, and the other thing is this web idea, which I think is an amazing way to view history as a historian. So sort of for me, she's prompting ideas about what history might be, and what, of course, this is what Australian history might be. So much has not been researched about Emily. I mean, there's been very little archival research done. She did have an experience of times throughout the 20th century. There are police records around. There are all sorts of station diaries, records and memories that could be researched. And of course, she worked with different animals, which surely gave her different visions and vantage point, like seeing the world from a horse or a camel. If she did ride them, you'd have to actually research that and not just make assumptions. She may have tended them or looked after them. There's a lot of knowledge that, you know, perhaps some people who knew Emily already have that knowledge and it's quite simple to get, but other things can be cross-checked and verified. And so I'd like to say a few things in particular about the pastoral industry in Central Australia, but also like to comment that she did go through an incredibly important change with the land rights movement. And there were a lot of tensions in the 70s and total changes in the relationships between the white people and the Aborigines due to a dramatic political change when land rights actually came to Utopia. Before that, there'd been a long history of pastoral engagement. And it's not exactly the same sort of history that Sally's implying about saying don't speak your own language. Well, in fact, the Central Australian pastoralists were small family, they ran their relatively small blocks, and they weren't the big Vestes or Bovril estates, the big multinationals that sometimes had a very impersonal, speculative attitude to these pastoral runs. These families sort of put their life into it. And a lot of the kids spoke the local languages, and so did the pastoral bosses. And there's different ways of viewing that contact experience in the pastoral industry. And until recently, the general view of left-wing white Australians was that they were totally exploited because they didn't get wages. But I think that it's important and it's evident in Emily's work that they did hold on to country and they held on to knowledge. They didn't lose their languages. They, in fact, appropriated modernity in a similar way to what Sally was saying by working with the cattle people in using their knowledge and exploiting their skills and their close observation of animals, their knowledge of resources. They were the majority of people in the industry. They were the majority of people in Central Australia. Missionaries were not actually telling them to read the Bible. In fact, a lot of the pastoralists didn't want them to be that well educated. And the conditions of contact and the underdevelopment, relatively speaking, in this area did shape their life in such a way as they could continue to be people who could progress and become ceremonial elders and keepers like Emily did. Some of the employers were quite paternalistic, and they did allow what are called walkabouts and ceremonies and so forth. And the reason there was flexibility and control, which sometimes suited the local Indigenous people, was because they were running the show and pulling the strings. Also, as you probably heard, Emily was a camel lady. But I don't really know whether she rode the camel or fed the camel or what she did with the camel. And it's exactly when in her life she was a camel lady. But if she was around when the Mahomets of Alice Springs or the Afghans were around, we're missing a very important encounter engagement with Muslim ascetics, because they had prayer mats, they had fancy saddles that they made, they often wore very ornate clothes for special occasions, even though they're quite simple clothes you see there. And they had those amazing hookah pipe things and quite ornate objects that they brought from the Afghanistan, Pakistan region, depending on the tribal group that they came from. So there's an interesting congruence there about nomadism and an encounter with people who are viewed as nomads, what nomadism means. So there's a lot of debates about that. So certainly if she was up on top of a camel or up on top of a horse or in a Toyota or an aeroplane, she'd be seeing country differently. And I think that's all very interesting. But anyway, there are so many themes I'd love to explore, so many questions I'd like to try to answer that you can do through archival research. once again, we've got more lines, timelines, and then there's that wonderful, that embodiment, which takes me to the relationship with country. Now, we know that that's really central, but I'd also like to point out that this nurturing of country that Indigenous people do and the nurturing that country does for them is not something that works in the present. It's something that works through time that goes way back into deep time. I mean, you are looking 40, 50,000 years. And I think that that's really astonishing. It's a very different worldview from ours, where we might think 220. It's really quite mind-boggling when you think of it. How many generations is that? As Galeroy Yunupingu said in 1988, it's a blink of an eyelid that white people have been in our country. But country and understanding the whole lot is about history too. When Emily's people walked around her country, they saw stuff. Like, there's the more recent stuff, the stone tools and things discarded by perhaps people they knew or perhaps people long ago, campsites. There's geological features that were made even before humans were there, and there's only spirit creatures. So in this understanding of the whole lot, there's a whole lot of history, I'd argue. History is powerful and history is ever-present in the landscape. Stanner actually called the dreaming every when, and yet we use that terrible term timeless, and we're always talking about Aboriginal culture. And this happened in the 2020 summit. I was really annoyed that everything was like culture. Culture implies something static. It goes down to the science of anthropology and the way they framed this definition for culture. We Australians might have culture, non-Indigenous Australians, all Australians have culture, but it's as though only people with text have history and Aboriginal people have culture rather than history. So I think we're still denying the historical dynamism of Aboriginal people, and there's a lot invested in that in Europe too, because of course, you know, if you go to the Musée de Quaibronlie and so forth, there's very much a primitivist model. And if you've gone to Tokyo or Osaka, there's very much the modern white cube. And so we are still exploring these ideas of primitive or modern. And of course, it's ironic that someone who is from the culture that in the 19th century and early 20th century, all the ethnologists were saying was the most primitive on the earth, in fact, created this amazingly sophisticated modern take on landscape. So time is visible to Indigenous people when they look at their country. They don't see it as static. They do see it as culture, but they see culture as something dynamic and living. Out of interest, I looked at, and this is there, of course, you're familiar with the this vital practice of relationship between person and country in a very intimate way. And telling stories and singing and dancing as part of that ever retelling, continuous retelling. So I think that, I was just about to say that I looked up what Australian history books were available in Japanese translation, and it was Manning Clark's Short History of Australia, and it was Geoffrey Blainey's Shorter History of Australia. And I sort of thought, well, maybe Emily's telling the longer history of Australia. Do that. Singing the stories is another important theme, because I don't think the art totally stands alone in many ways, because when Emily was alive, she went down to a Sydney gallery or where she was hosting launches and exhibition openings, and she used to sing. And of course, there's a very spiritual dimension to that singing, and it is about song lines and journeys. And I do think that that is an incredibly important theme. Gloria joined in when she was singing at the opening in Sydney in, I think it was 1992. And I was very moved indeed in Osaka when Gloria sang for Emily's paintings. So that is really very powerful, and I think that's part of the history lines being connected up with other parts of the world. And I know that that was talked about in a previous paper today, so I won't go into that in much detail. But I do wonder, Aboriginal people believe they were born here in Australia, they've always been here. I'm wondering if these storylines keep going around the world like this, I sometimes wonder whether that might change. Because the power of those stories are now going global. So the singing keeps the paintings alive and the country alive and the history alive. Bringing songs and bringing stories from afar empowers them further. So I guess my main points, therefore, are that Emily and her work, like that of numerous other marvellous Indigenous artists, but perhaps Emily is a standout, having done these incredible, having given people in Japan these incredible experiences. When I was in Japan, I saw people just standing, really meditating and reflecting and experiencing these works. I might have to call them timelines again. So I guess I'm sort of saying, okay, think about culture and think about the land, but think about the history. And is this important to nation, to Australia? I think it is. It's about the way we see ourselves. It's about the way the world sees us. And there's one photograph, which I'll show you a bit later, which actually shows Emily painting a map of Australia. So I think she was quite aware of this sort of song lines circulating around the nation and the relevance of this as an intervention into the story of nation. Thinking about these lines as being about country but also stories in country, it relates to what the other speakers were saying about interconnectedness. But I think it could create a sort of historical revolution in Australia if we really took it seriously enough. I think the history wars were so bland and colourless and unnecessary. I think that what we've got is a new history staring us in the face. This is called creation. I don't know whether Emily really called it that, but creation, you know, that's certainly something to do with history, I think. And maybe Emily gives us some ideas about where to go with our history in the future. In fact, a Makmak woman from further north in the territory said that to her, her country's like a spider web, where all the history lines are joined up. I just thought, pick the princess. that's Emily doing her map of Australia. Well, that's what the caption says. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. And that marvellous image of her where she is, you know, a symbol for her own country and its history way back in deep time before amazing geographical features were even there in her country. And just to finish here, I'd like to say that I think that there's a global span of a web of meaning that is about history as well as about culture. And I think that perhaps it's Aboriginal people who'll be telling the story in the future to other countries other than Japan. I think they've already started to do that in France. And I think that those relationships with the world might change something about our own relationships with deep time and our understanding of what 1788 might mean in relation to that. And just finally, I found a photograph, just in case you thought that John Mundine was exaggerating before about Australian police attitudes. This was a photo I took on the day of the apology. This guy is smoking. This security guard from Parliament House is really worried. And then he goes, And he's following him along. He follows him along, and they try and scoot out towards the bush or something, but this guy, yes. It just seems such an odd scene when everybody else was sort of embracing and trying to come to terms with the whole sadness of the stolen children, which did affect the Utopia people too. As long as it's not one of my teenage daughters doing something I shouldn't be doing. Is that Barbara?
No, that's not her mum.
That's Barbara Nicholson.
It's not. Did she say she's somewhere else that day?
No, there's a nicer one of her.
Oh, no, she's hugging.
There she is, see? There she is. And then there's my daughter. Australia has a black history. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, that's a lot nice light note too. Almost end on. Thank you, Anne McGrath.
So that's a nice little twist at the end, and I'm glad you found your mum. Okay, thank you. Just before we're well on time, we've got another 20 minutes. We don't have to take 20 minutes, but we have it if we need it. If there's anyone who'd like to comment, respond, add to and stuff or make any comment on the kind of texture of the day or any other things that have since occurred to you, because I know it's not always, you can't always think of things you need to say until later after a cup of tea or something.
And I just wanted to ask regarding the Indigenous modes of history research that you, Margot and Francis did together, and in relation to Emily, when and Papanya Tula, when it was the exhibition was up earlier this late last year, using paintings as text. What was your summary of that when you went through your historical analysis?
Well, that was a very different exhibition because there were really big captions, you know, which talked about the symbols in the paintings. One of the things I thought was quite interesting, possibly a breakthrough, was that there were photographic portraits of the artists there. Nearly every one of them was wearing stockman's hats. Nearly every man was in a stockman's hat. So it sort of showed that this, you know, the sheep and cattle had been really important to their identity. But, yeah, as history as text, it was a very rich exhibition for that theme. And I've got the book and I mean, haven't read it all yet. But yeah, I think that, you know, the analysis that goes on in the catalogue can also contribute to an exhibition. I remember when I first saw the Osaka exhibition, I was shocked that there weren't captions and text with it. And I guess now I'm sort of seeing what an important debate that is in the art world and how culturally bound we are to always think we've got to understand things via writing first, and how important it is often, as we've been discussing today, to just be confronted with the reality of the work, perhaps without the biography of somebody. You know, so I'm not arguing that they should be together, but I'm certainly arguing that seeing Emily as such a significant person in Australian history, that there should be deeper research done into her own life and its context and the cattle industry in Central Australia and sheep.
Just taking that a bit further, I remember, I think it was early last year, we had the whole Queenie McKenzie debate, the fact that she had a painting that was talking about Massacre Creek. I think it was Massacre Creek, and that painting then had a huge public debate about whether or not it should have been part of a national history collection, simply because it wasn't there wasn't any backup documentation to say that that painting was a recording of a true event. How does your understanding of painting as a documentation of Aboriginal people writing their history through this painting, how does that relate to the research that you've done?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one because I guess you could say the painting is whatever the artist wants it to be. And, I mean, we create works that are fictional works about, you know, historical fiction is a genre. So I guess, you know, a lot of Aboriginal people talk about their country as the country tells no lies, and so they do believe it to be a truth, an intrinsic truth. So then you get into that whole argument about the truth of history and what is truth. And in fact, when you look at the history of writing history in the Western world, in Europe, it was more closely allied to historical fiction in the 18th century. And so it's actually quite recent that it's become like truth-oriented and positivist.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I just want to comment. I liked I think you're attempting to talk about with creating a biography and a history around Emily and also placing her into history that most probably common people aren't generally treated seriously in history at all, or it's been this way that history has changed, and you can then see common people as actually having been very active in history. I mean, the time of Emily's birth, you know, women practically had just got the vote. So these things, her life is symptomatic of many things. And I liked your list of things, but I couldn't photographically get it down. I just think it should be taken more seriously. I was just thinking on, if I can digress a bit, or you allow me to digress a bit, on the previous speakers that I sort of was sitting through, and about this business of modernism and Emily, one could come away with an impression that Emily was a great modernist, that she'd actually published books about the theory of modernism. And I think from the last speakers, and that in fact that Aboriginal art comes from another history, and 200 years of some interaction doesn't mean that we've totally absorbed Western art history. And I use the term we. And I thought the thought that escaped me previously was how we get hung up on explaining things maybe too much in Western terms. In fact, maybe in Europe they don't even talk about these things so much anymore. And John von Sturm, a friend of mine, said most probably the last full chamber orchestra playing Mozart will be found sometime in the future in South Korea, when everyone stopped playing Mozart in England and Europe and Germany. That it'll only exist in some other funny little corner of the empire. We're still trying to live like full Englishmen or full Europeans, and we have to carve out our own histories, not carve them out. We have to discover our own histories and believe in our own histories and our own ways of dealing with art, possibly. There are many antecedents for terms in European history, like country, like relationship to land, etc., but that we must be able to live our own lives in some way. I thought the images of relationships to land, those body images of women's breasts and so on, which were always a bit problematical given the Henson debate. How many naked Aboriginal people can you see in books? In fact, there are books full of very small naked Aboriginal children that are published and still being published and are very popular, certainly amongst a certain set. But anyway, harking back to that image of the body, painted body, just to remember that most probably the painting, in Aboriginal terms, the painting isn't a representation of something. It is that something. when you paint your body is the land. It isn't a representation of it. It is the thing. There was one other thing. I think one should be very careful when you talk about ritual. I think there's a saying in Aboriginal society, you can read all the books you want. Unless you've been there, you can't talk about it. You don't understand what happens. I remember a Christian, very Christian anthropologist who refused to go to a certain major ritual I went to. He was asking me questions from the book. Oh, do they dress like this? Do they dress like that? I could have told him they dress in drag like on Oxford Street and he wouldn't have been none the wiser. As a saying, you have to know things before you can comment about them. Now, art has a responsibility and has a social result. I've seen older people die from the shock of seeing culture being trivialised or mistreated. I've seen lots of family interactions, very violent interactions, etc., because people are put in positions where they don't fulfil particular rituals according to certain procedures and so on. So the whole idea of people making art in a ritual, you reaffirm your associations to each other, and they have very strong social responses from those reaffirmations. And I think no one should trivialise those things because still they do have repercussions. And Aboriginal people believe beyond just family domestics or arguments or inter-family feuds, which are bad enough, that in fact it does upset things in a spiritual sense and it does have repercussions in a spiritual sense that manifests itself in full-on climatic and other actions and events. So you shouldn't go away from here thinking Emily was a great postmodernist or modernist in that sense. Otherwise she would have had Toyotas and Harbour Bridges and McDonald's, etc. in her compositions. It still comes back to, like I said, actually reading the sign. Certainly not trying to reincorporate yourself, reincorporate Eurocentric views into things. If you have a civilization that's come from 30,000 years, 40,000 years, it's not to be trivialised or misread. And I only mean that in the sense of suddenly saying, hey, I'm Aboriginal this week. Or I saw the Mornington Island dance group dance. Or I saw somebody create a ground painting. In fact, watching someone create a ground painting here is the stuff of tourism. It's not the actual ritual. That's all. Thanks. I don't want to be a grumpy old man. Thanks.
Thank you, John, for his second speech of the day, but it was welcome. They're the things he forgot to say before. Thank you very much. Sally, do you want to say something?
Yes, thanks.
Is it on?
It's on.
Sally Butler.
Okay. Just to respond to John, and I take on board what you're saying, but I certainly don't want anyone to think that in any way I am trivialising the Aboriginal concept of ritual. And in fact, I'd also like to say that the definition of ritual that I was referring to, certainly I had grand paintings and ceremonial dance up there, but particularly with Emily and Ware, the ritualistic behaviour of, gathering bush tucker, etc., that's not secret sacred at all, is far more a part of her art than anything to do with secret sacred ritual. So certainly there's no aspect of attempting to say that I understand secret sacred ritual or, in fact, to trivialise it, but also to say that ritual has a more general frame of reference than that what John's speaking about. But I totally take on board what John's saying, but I just wanted to sort of reply that that really wasn't the intention. Thanks.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.